How did Jeff Bezos realize you could sell anything on the internet? Why did Bill Gates create Control-Alt-Delete? How did synchronized swimming prepare Christine Lagarde for international politics? What made Bob Iger bet big on Marvel? And what inspired Diane von Furstenberg to create the wrap dress? On the David Rubenstein Show, Peer-to-Peer Conversations, I uncover the untold stories of the world's most successful leaders. Listen now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to For the Ages, a history podcast presented by the New York Historical Society and hosted by David Rubenstein. Join us as he deftly explores the rich and complex history of the United States with some of the nation's foremost historians and creative thinkers. Because history matters.
I'm David Rubenstein, and we're going to continue our conversation with Kate Anderson Brower about her book, Elizabeth Taylor, The Grit and Glamour of an Icon. Thank you very much for joining us again for the second part of our conversation, Kate.
Thank you, David.
So let me ask you about the movie Cleopatra. In those days, movie stars signed multi-year contracts, and the movie studios told you what movies you're going to produce. You didn't pick the ones you wanted to be in. And then when your contract was up, you could go do something else. She had a long-term multi-picture contract with MGM. Did she want to get out of it early? Did they let her out, or they forced her to stay until the end?
They forced her to stay and do Butterfield 8, where she plays a woman who's essentially a high-class prostitute. And she thought that was really torture. She thought it was kind of her punishment for her affair with Eddie Fisher at the time.
It was perhaps punishment, but in the end, she won the Academy Award for Best Actress for that. Is that right?
She did, and she never thought she deserved it in a million years. I mean, it was not her best film.
So to go back to Cleopatra, so she is going to make this movie where it's going to be not filmed in Egypt. One of the reasons it couldn't be filmed in Egypt is that she was Jewish and she bought Israel bonds. And anybody that bought Israel bonds can't be allowed to film a movie in Egypt, presumably. So they decided to build a big set in England. So instead of having a lot of heat and the desert, you got a lot of fog and rain.
That's right. That's right. And she had very delicate health, you know, and she got very sick with pneumonia.
And the pneumonia became so serious that she had to be hospitalized. And what happened as a result of the hospitalization in terms of the need to make her possible for her to breathe?
Well, so she needed a tracheotomy. And that is actually, she won for Butterfield 8 because it was a sympathy vote from the Academy because people felt badly. They had been so critical of Elizabeth for her relationship with Eddie Fisher. And then when she almost died, because people really thought she was going to die, and the head of the studio thought she was going to die, and she was close to death. She said she saw Mike Todd and that she saw a great white light and that she went to another place. I don't know if she would have considered it heaven. And then Mike Todd told her, you have to go back. You have work to do.
Well, you point out in your book that she got so much sympathy that even Debbie Reynolds said she would vote for her for the Oscar, and she did vote for her, right?
She said she did, which is kind of hard to believe.
So when Elizabeth Taylor shows up for the Oscar ceremony, she doesn't wear jewelry. She allows her scar from her tracheotomy to be shown, getting some sympathy, perhaps. The votes had already been cast. And then I think you point out, what did Shirley MacLaine say about this, that she had lost to?
Lost to a tracheotomy. That's right. Yeah. And Elizabeth wanted everyone to see that scar. All of her scars were battle scars.
So to finish on Cleopatra, the movie takes a lot of time to get done. It's over budget. New producer comes in. It costs the equivalent of how much to make in today's dollars, almost $400 or $500 million.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of money. And they end up bringing in Joseph Mankiewicz to rewrite it. And he conceives of this very complicated two-part, several-hour, you know, movie that, of course, Spiros Skouros at Fox does not want to make because he doesn't think anyone's going to want to watch Cleopatra with Julius Caesar in Act One and then Cleopatra with Mark Antony in the second act. It's a complete mess, and it drove everyone crazy, and it took her years and years to finish shooting that film.
So did the movie win any awards for best film, or did she win any Oscars for it?
She didn't win anything for that film, but it wasn't the huge disaster that I think some people might assume. it did get bought for TV, and then they did make back that money eventually from that film. But it cost a huge amount of money to make. And it was funny, later in life, she would drive by the Fox studio and say, I almost destroyed that studio. I know it well. You know, it was a huge problem for Fox at the time.
So she's making the movie while she's still married to Eddie Fisher. Not the greatest marriage, perhaps, but married to him. But she's conducting an affair with Richard Burton, but she's not mentioning to anybody she's having this affair. Is that right?
Well, it was pretty hard not to notice the two of them on the set. They were kind of all over each other. They weren't hiding it at all. And when she met him on the set, she had met him once before years earlier, and she thought he was kind of a blowhard, arrogant stage actor. And then she meets him on the set, and he's so hungover from a night of heavy drinking that he can't bring the coffee cup to his lips. And she just finds that incredibly, you know, sexy that he's in need of her help. And I think that says a lot about her, that she's drawn to broken people that she needs to kind of nurture in a way. And then the two of them are together all the time.
Now, Richard Burton had a reputation for having affairs with his leading ladies, but his wife, Sybil, said, well, he always comes back to me. So did she actually think he was going to leave her for Elizabeth Taylor?
Never. No. She thought that this would just be like one of his many affairs. But this time it was different because they were really soulmates. And in these letters between them, you can just see this passion and this fire and the conflicts that they had, the fights they had were so passionate. When he does leave Sybil and his two young daughters, Kate Burton, this wonderful actress, is one of them. She goes on to become an actor. He's racked with guilt, and it does color their marriage for sure.
So when do they actually get married? Where do they get married? And was it a big paparazzi festival or bonanza?
No, when they finally get married, it's in Montreal in 1964, and they're in just a hotel suite. It's actually one of her less over-the-top ceremonies. I think Nicky Hilton was the most kind of lavish wedding ceremony she ever had.
So she and Richard Burton begin to act together in some other movies other than Cleopatra, and I think one of the most famous ones was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yes. And by that point in 1966, they are so powerful that they could actually choose their director. And they chose Mike Nichols, who had never done a movie before. He was young. Nobody believed that Elizabeth could pull off that role of Martha. She had to gain weight, which she said was her best assignment for any role ever. And she had to age herself by more than a decade and be this bitter, unhappy woman, which she really wasn't. And she does a masterful job in it.
Does she win an Academy Award for this?
She does, and Richard doesn't, and Elizabeth doesn't go to the ceremony to collect the award, and Bancroft accepts it on her behalf. And I think that's very sad. I mean, it does kind of say a lot about that relationship, that there was professional jealousy there, that Richard didn't get, you know, he got nominated, but he didn't win, and he was upset.
So they have a very tempestuous, I think is a fair word to use, marriage. And ultimately, they get divorced. After how many years were they married?
A decade.
So after they get divorced, she goes her own way. And does she have another love interest at that time?
She dates an actual used car salesman, not seriously, but and then, you know, dates another kind of Swiss playboy. She doesn't ever find anybody who compares to Richard. So she's very unfulfilled.
How do they get reconciled and marry a second time?
Well, they have this moment where Elizabeth goes for a checkup to her doctors, and her doctors tell her that she has a spot on her lung. And she tells Richard that she thinks she's dying of lung cancer. And there's this dramatic moment where she convinces him basically to get married. And I interviewed Sally Burton, Richard's wife, when he passed away, and she said that she thought Elizabeth made the whole thing up. Which she didn't, because I have access to her diary and her letters. Unless she's making up what she's writing, she describes the whole event where she thought life is short. Let's get married again. Let's give it another try.
All right. So the first marriage lasts 10 years. How long does the second marriage last?
A year, about a year, less than a year, actually. It's not a great second you know, he was drunk when they got married. It was 75 to 76. I mean, they get married in Africa on safari. He's hungover. She is giddy and excited. And then, you know, he starts drinking again and it's a mess.
So they get divorced. And so Elizabeth says, well, maybe I'll find somebody else. Who does she find to be her next husband?
Well, she ends up dating Ardeshir Sahidi, who was the Iranian ambassador to the U.S. in D.C. And he was a very good looking, smart, handsome man. I interviewed him. And then at the same time, she's dating John Warner, who was a Republican Secretary of the Navy, Virginia horseman, very attractive, debonair, old fashioned person. And she falls in love with both of them and ends up picking Warner because she knew that, you know, it wasn't going to work out if she married Zahidi. It was too difficult. His former father-in-law was the Shah of Iran, and he didn't want him to marry a movie star.
Or somebody was Jewish.
Yeah, that was a problem too.
So John Warner was, as you say, Secretary of Navy. He'd been the head of the Bicentennial, pointed to that by Richard Nixon. And John Warner decides to run for the United States Senate, and he loses in the Republican primary, even though Elizabeth Taylor campaigns for him. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, surprisingly.
And then the person to whom he lost is killed in a plane crash. So Warner becomes the Republican nominee, and he gets elected to the Senate.
Yeah, and it was really Elizabeth being there by his side. It was a very short period of time when he is running after Obenshain dies in this plane crash. And Elizabeth goes all over Virginia, you know, and does small, you know, barbecues and all of these things you can't imagine Elizabeth Taylor doing. And she is his secret weapon, and he wouldn't have won without her.
So Elizabeth Taylor helps her husband get elected. But then what does a Senate wife do if you're Elizabeth Taylor? The Senate wives, as you point out, they're often rolling bandages and doing other kinds of volunteer work that's not exactly that high profile. So does she go up and roll bandages and other things with the other Senate wives?
At first she tries to, and then realizes that this is not going to work. She got close to Teresa Hines Carey, which I think is interesting because Teresa would be the only other person kind of in that world who she could relate to, I think. But she's a fish out of water. She hates Washington. I think she honestly thought she was going to be a political partner to John Warner and play some role in politics. I wondered if she was interested in being first lady, you know, someday. I never found evidence of that. But when she realizes that Warner was going to leave her home alone and not miss a vote, and she was eating and drinking all the time and just desperately lonely, and she started doing drugs and really descend into a deep depression.
She also starts eating a lot, and people are beginning to comment on how big she's become, and people actually on television are making fun of how overweight she's become, and that must have really upset her.
It's amazing to watch these interviews with her where she's overweight, and the person interviewing her actually says, you know, why have you gotten so fat? And you just think, I mean, today you would never say that to someone. It's so insensitive. And Joan Rivers makes fun of her constantly. Elizabeth chokes on a chicken bone when she's helping Warner get elected. And it becomes late night fodder. SNL does a skit about it. And she's embarrassed. You know, she's a human being.
So how long does this marriage last?
This lasts from 76 to 82. And really the thing about Warner, he said he still loved her. She said he wasn't the love of my life and I wasn't the love of his life, but we loved each other. And so they did help each other, but in the end, they were just way too different. She was liberal and, you know, she believed in gun control. She wanted to take out an ad after Reagan was almost killed. There are these great letters between her and Warner where he says, oh, Elizabeth, you shouldn't do this. Think about what it could mean for our children. It puts them in danger. And she does it anyway. But it's really him just trying to not hurt his base.
So ultimately, they get divorced in 1982. And then she moves back to California, where she had more or less been living before she married Warner. Is that right?
Yes. And she starts this new chapter.
And then she decides ultimately to check herself into Betty Ford Clinic and get some rehabilitation for her alcohol and drug problems. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's right. And she's very public about it.
So at Betty Ford Clinic, she meets somebody. You might not think that's the greatest place to find a partner or a spouse, but she meets somebody there. And who is that?
It is a construction worker named Larry Fortinsky. But that was in the 90s when they got married. In between there, she did her AIDS activism. I mean, when she was single was when she was the most herself, which I always thought was so interesting.
But Fortinsky is her last husband. Is that right?
He is. Yep.
And how long does that last?
That's 91 to 96. He starts drinking again. He had never even been on a plane before he married Elizabeth Taylor. Suddenly he is traveling all over the world and nobody can understand what she sees in him. Her friends don't like him. He becomes controlling and they actually hire armed guards there at her house because her staff is worried that Larry is going to do something crazy. They just don't trust him.
So after that marriage, does she say, okay, I'm not going to get married anymore? And she stops looking to get married and she decides to continue other things in her life?
I think so. She was a passionate, she always said, full-fledged person until the day she died when she was 79 years old. So I think if she had found the right person, she would have gotten married again, but she didn't.
Let me ask you about one final person that she did not marry, but who you said she had a relationship with, Frank Sinatra. So can you tell us about that relationship and what that led to ultimately?
They were actually lifelong friends, but they had a brief romantic relationship. She did get pregnant. He was insistent that she have an abortion and he paid for her to go down to Mexico to get the abortion. And she was very bitter about that, you know, and I do wonder, that would be a question I would have for her, you know, how was that decision made and does she regret doing it? I don't know if she would have wanted to have a baby at that time in her life. She was very young. But to be sort of told by him that he wouldn't take any ownership over the child, and it was very difficult. And then he wouldn't help her with AIDS at first. He later did help her, but he wouldn't get involved in her AIDS work.
I see.
Yeah, it was a challenging relationship.
So in the end, she lives to 79 years of age. What in the end causes her death? What illness prompted her to pass away?
I think in the end, it was a heart disease related illness. She was very sick for a long time, in and out of the hospital. But even during her last trip to the hospital, her assistant told me she got her makeup done. I mean, she never came home. She died in the hospital, which was a huge regret of her family's.
So her legacy to the industry is what? What would you say? She left behind a reputation for being a great actress and a great star. And what would you say that people today in the industry remember her for?
I think it's for her AIDS activism. I think it's for using her celebrity to really, you know, lessen the stigma attached to this terrible disease. And also to lessen the homophobia that was rampant at the time. But as far as her acting goes, she was a fierce woman who was a self-trained actor who, I think she was always intimidated by Richard Burton, but in the end, she won the Oscar and he didn't. So there was a natural talent there.
Many of the actresses with whom she competed for roles were people that had been trained by professional teachers to make people actors or actresses. She never had that training. Did she ever feel a lack of professionalism by not having it? Or she said, I've won the Academy Awards twice. I don't need any training.
I think she was intimidated by Marlon Brando, Montgomery Clift, these method actors. I think for her at the beginning, that was very difficult, that she wasn't being taken seriously. She felt by that school of kind of Broadway stage actors who became the character they were playing. She never bought into that. You know, people underestimated her all the time. Paul Newman said when they were doing Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, he said to the director, you know, I don't think Elizabeth is doing this very well. And the director said, you have to look at the rushes, you have to see what she's doing. And when he saw her on a screen, Paul Newman realized that she was doing a lot of subtle things with her face and her mannerisms that you couldn't necessarily see when you were acting with her, because she was just very good at it.
So she did how many movies in her life? About 60 movies, something like that?
She did. She did 56 films and 10 TV movies. I mean, unfortunately, her last film was The Flintstones. I say unfortunately. I mean, that was an entertaining movie, but it isn't at the level of, you know, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof or Giant, for instance.
So of the movies that she made, the most enduring one and probably the best known ones are National Velvet, I guess you could say, Butterfield 8, for which she won the Academy Award. Also, Cleopatra, of course, and then Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and then Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Would those be her epic movies? And Giant.
Giant, A Place in the Sun, I would put there. George Stevens did help her quite a bit, even though she couldn't stand him personally. He gave her a chance in A Place in the Sun to do something pretty incredible with the role that, you know, she always was getting cast as just the pretty rich girl. And yes, that character is a pretty rich girl, but there's so much more to that character that she brings to it.
So in doing all this research for 2.5 years, what was the most surprising thing to you?
I think it was that she, even Elizabeth, had to fight for what she wanted in life, you know, that she had to keep on fighting for the roles that she wanted and fighting for things she believed in. I think, you know, I came into it thinking that she was a very fearless woman. And her family told me, you know, she wasn't fearless, she was courageous. She had a lot of concerns about, you know, for instance, she was concerned about, at one point she had a blister on her hand and she was going to an AIDS hospice. And she was worried that she might somehow get sick because she didn't know how it was transmitted at the time. This was in the mid 80s. But she went anyway. And I think it was kind of the courageousness in her life. The level of it was surprising to me.
So if you had a chance to interview Elizabeth Taylor today, knowing everything you know, what are the one or two questions you most want to ask her?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I mean, I would ask her if she thought she would she have done anything differently as far as being a mother, you know, did she make any mistakes? Because her kids told me a lot of stories about times that they needed her, that she wasn't there for them or couldn't be there for them. But, you know, you have to sympathize with her. She was a working mother. And did she have any regrets? What issue would she take on today? What would be her cause today now that HIV and AIDS, there's no cure, but it's more of a manageable disease if you have access to resources.
I grew up in an era when Elizabeth Taylor was a great movie star. I never met her, but I always watched a lot about her and read about her and saw a lot of her movies. And I would say I learned a lot in your book, which I certainly enjoyed.
Thank you.
So I assume you enjoyed putting this together and you enjoyed learning about this person you knew about from afar.
I did. And I kind of fell in love with her. I think she's a trendsetter, you know. I think she is the original influencer. And I love that she was a very flawed person. And when I first signed on to do it, I told her family that I wanted to do a warts and all biography. And they said, okay. And I was worried that some of the addiction stories and the selfishness and all that would get, you know, taken out. But they were really true to their word. So I love that they were okay being honest about her problems, because that makes her human.
Well, I would say, Kate, this is a really interesting book. I appreciate your giving us this much time, and I highly recommend it. Thank you for this conversation.
David, that means a lot. Thank you.
On behalf of the New York Historical Society, thank you for joining us for another episode of For the Ages, a History Podcast, hosted by David Rubenstein. We hope you enjoyed it and come back for more. Thanks for your support. You can share your thoughts at public.programs@nyhistory.org.